Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Parkinson's disease is one of the most debilitating and fastest-growing brain diseases. Over the past 25 years, the number of people worldwide with Parkinson's has jumped from 3 million to 6 million. By 2040, that number is expected to double again, impacting more than 12 million people. The most effective treatment was developed over 50 years ago, and research funding for Parkinson's has not increased relative to the number of people impacted. Moreover, the pesticides and chemicals linked to Parkinson's are still in our water and soil. Later in the hour, we discuss local supports and services for Parkinson's patients and caregivers. But first, we welcome two leading Parkinson's doctors who've proposed a path to end Parkinson's, including a push for innovation in treatment and steps to prevent the disease. With us is Dr. Michael Okun, Chair of Neurology at the University of Florida and one of the world's leading Parkinson's researchers who's advanced surgical treatments for the disease. He's also the National Medical Director of the Parkinson's Foundation. Welcome, Dr. Okun.
Hi, welcome. It's great to have you and great to be with you and great to have Ray with us too.
Yeah, and Ray Dorsey, Professor of Neurology at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Center for Health and Technology. For the past decade, he's used telemedicine to improve care for individuals with Parkinson's disease. Good morning to you, Dr. Dorsey.
Good morning. Please call me Ray. Thank you very much for having me.
You got it. Okay. Dr. Okun and Dr. Sotsi, along with Dr. Shira Blum, are the authors of the book Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. And rates of Parkinson's are increasing, as we mentioned, and that's likely to continue into the next two decades. In the book, you likened it to a looming pandemic. Dr. Okun, what are some of the reasons that these rates are increasing so steadily?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And one of the, you know, really interesting stories about the book, for anybody who's ever been an author, oftentimes the title changes multiple times, and we work with the publisher, and the original title of the book was actually The Parkinson's Pandemic. And wouldn't that have been great if that had stayed? Nobody knew that we were headed for a COVID-19, you know, pandemic. But the reason that we talked about that, and we've had this notion going all the way back to 2013, is the word pandemic. Pan means all and demos means people. And the word wasn't originally designed just to describe infectious etiologies. In fact, it predates, you know, a lot of what we knew about what was infectious and what was not. But certainly we agree with the idea that the World Health Organization mainly reserves the word to talk this word to talk about things that are infectious. But if you look at Parkinson's, you say, oh my gosh, it has all of the same characteristics. It's growing, you know, at an uncontrollable pace that has the potential to impact economic and healthcare systems. It is the most rapidly expanding neurological disease now, which is really something that's shocking. It does not spare anyone. No one's immune, and it's global. And so it sort of checks all these boxes for a pandemic. So although we don't use the word, it brings up a really important dialogue.
Mm. Ray, describe how Parkinson's affects the brain.
So it turns out that Parkinson's, although we classically think of it as a brain disease, actually in many cases likely begins outside the brain. And it might begin in the nose or the gut. And some of the earliest features of the disease are loss of smell and constipation. And from there, the disease, in some cases, spreads to the brain. In all cases, the brain is eventually affected and affects parts of the brain that are responsible for movement. So some of the cardinal features of the disease are slowness in movement, involuntary tremor, a stooped posture, and a shuffling gait. And later in the disease, the pathology continues to spread throughout the brain and can cause dementia and hallucinations.
Mm. So the disease impacts people very differently, right? Some people have more cognitive issues, others more physical issues. Ray, do we know why that is?
We don't have a good sense. Maybe Michael will have a better answer, but we don't know. We think some of the symptoms are related to where the pathology of Parkinson's is found. So some people early on lose a sense of smell, and so we think that might give us a clue to where the disease might be beginning and where the portals of entry to the disease might be. Some constipation is an early feature. Some have prominent depression and anxiety. In those individuals, the pathology of Parkinson's can be found in parts of the brain that are responsible for controlling mood. But we don't know why individuals have such different responses, even for the genetic causes of the disease.
Michael, do you have more to add to that?
Yeah, so, you know, I think one really important thing for the listeners to appreciate is this idea that Parkinson's is not one disease. And in fact, one of our colleagues and co-authors, Bastian Bloom and Nijmegen in the Netherlands, likes to say Parkinson's diseases. And so when you think about Parkinson's, we don't necessarily think of it like we used to. So there is this old picture from 1886, this old sketch from a neurologist or an early, what would be, you know, considered today a neurologist, William Gowers, or neuroscientist. There looks like this old man hunched over and, you know, has, you know, Parkinson. And we have now sort of converted this image. And there's a nice article by Melissa Armstrong in JAMA Neurology talking about the new image of Parkinson. It isn't just one subtype like that man you see in the sketch. It can be men, it can be women. You can give medicines, you can give electrical stimulation, lots of different treatments, but people can look lots of different ways. And in fact, a lot of people have Parkinson's and you don't even know they have Parkinson's because they may not even have tremor. And so we have multiple subtypes. Not all are genetic. And in fact, genetics only makes up 10 or 15%. And so there is environmental influences that we're beginning to learn about as well. And so I think the summary is that statement. We're dealing with Parkinson's diseases and Parkinson's subtypes, and that makes it a little more confusing, I think, for the public to understand the scale of the problem that we face.
Mm. So, Dr. Okun, getting a diagnosis then isn't as simple as just getting a test, right? So how is the disease diagnosed?
Yeah, it may surprise a lot of folks, but the, you know, most common way to get a diagnosis of Parkinson, and still the best way, is an old-fashioned physical examination with some time in the office where somebody that has some expertise, either a neurologist or maybe a neurologist with training in Parkinson's, although we have a dramatic shortage of these sorts of people all over the world. And in certain countries, we have, you know, extreme shortages of neurologists. But we do need to focus our efforts to try to help in the diagnosis and help people to understand that you don't need all these fancy tests. What you need is a good examination and a good physical, and that it comes down to that. Very rarely do we need to run these super expensive tests to make the diagnosis.
Hmm. The book Ending Parkinson's is structured around a PACT, an acronym for Prevent Disease, Advocate for Protective Policies, Care for Patients, Treat the Condition with Innovative Therapies. Let's talk about prevention. Ray, what do we know about the causes of Parkinson's? Dr. Okun sort of touched on there's a genetic component, environmental. Who is at greatest risk of developing the disease?
People who are at greatest risk are those who are exposed to environmental factors associated with the disease, and there are four big ones. One are certain pesticides. Second are industrial chemicals called trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene, widely used in dry cleaning and degreasing. Third is air pollution, and fourth is heavy metals. So we know from numerous studies by investigators around the world that farmers, rural residents, and those who drink well water, which is susceptible to contamination by pesticides, are at 50 to 150% increased risk for developing the disease. We know that there are clusters of Parkinson's disease associated with sites that are contaminated with trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene. We see that the rates of Parkinson's disease tend to follow air pollution throughout the world. We know that these chemicals enter the nose and the gut where the earliest symptoms of the disease are found. And we know that perchloroethylene has been contaminated Cape Cod, and 1.3 million pounds of pesticides are put on the grounds in Cape Cod annually. So this isn't just a national issue, this is a global issue, but this is one that's a local one for the Cape Cod community.
So are these chemicals a concern when it comes to Parkinson? Is there enough evidence about these links between exposure to these chemicals and Parkinson's to make a strong case to ban them?
Absolutely. And in fact, 32 countries have banned this pesticide called paraquat. It's considered the most toxic herbicide ever created. It kills the weeds that Roundup doesn't. It's been used to commit homicide and suicide. And 32 countries, including China, have banned it, but the United States has not. In fact, use of the chemical has doubled over the last 10 years, tripled over the last 25, and increased 20 to 30% over the last year. And worse, in October of 2020, just 3 months ago, the previous administration reapproved its use despite 100,000 signatures from the Parkinson's community seeking to have it banned.
So why have we been so slow to act? And you mentioning what happened in October, are there signs that the EPA under the Biden administration will be more receptive?
We're certainly hoping so. We're going to be launching a campaign to say that we give a dime about Parkinson's and looking to send 1,000 letters to the White House asking the new administration to ban paraquat and ban another pesticide, chlorpyrifos, and another chemical called TCE linked to Parkinson's disease, because we think to a large extent, at least many cases, just as Dr. Okun said, there are Parkinson's diseases. We think some of these diseases are indeed preventable, and the first step in our pact is to prevent the disease, and we can do that by eliminating the use of some of these chemicals.
Mm. Dr. Okun, what can we learn from incident rates in industrialized societies versus unindustrialized societies, as well as the different regions of the United States?
Yeah, so this is, you know, super important for us to keep in mind. And one of the things that can be a bit deceptive about how we collect information about the environment, we're learning now that, for example, when we look at things like air pollution or pesticides, we have to pay attention to the regions in which we collect the data. So if we're collecting data about air pollution and Parkinson's disease, that data is going to be far different in Asia, where those levels are higher than in other areas, like in North America. Although in some areas in North America, it may also be very high. And so we must pay attention to those regional effects and understand the methods that we're beginning to collect the information. But the really interesting thing is that about, you know, 20 years ago when Ray and I first started to get into this, you know, business and Parkinson's and our labs were starting to hum, you know, we really didn't appreciate this idea of pesticides and environment as much as we do today. And part of that is it takes time to see the science evolve and to see multiple studies showing the same thing over and over. And so Ray mentioned paraquat already banned in 32 countries, TCE, trichloroethylate. We're now seeing data in certain countries that is very suggestive of air pollutants. And when we think back even to that early history of Parkinson and the explosion of Parkinson, and even that early essay of James Parkinson in 1817, and we think about the industrialization of the world, and now we begin to look in specific regions, if we're careful in how we do our research, we're beginning to understand how these environmental impacts turn out to have health effects. And so we've been very good at this in cancers and other things, and it's time for Parkinson to join that conversation.
Mm. Do most drinking water standards include a threshold for these chemicals? Are there effective ways to remove it from the water?
So most water in the United States is regulated by the Safe Drinking Water Act, but water from private wells on people's properties, are not. And 40 million Americans get their water from these private wells, which are exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act. And they're often only tested when people buy and sell their property. And because many of these private wells tend to be in rural areas, they're very susceptible to runoff from pesticides from nearby farms. And so people could be drinking pesticide-contaminated water and not even know it. And this exposure could happen in early in somebody's life, even in childhood, and start the pathological processes that might lead to Parkinson's disease developing decades later.
Tim in Nantucket says, following the linkage with the pesticides mentioned, is there equivalent evidence about microplastics, or is it too early?
The microplastics really haven't been studied as much as pesticides, because pesticides are nerve toxins. They target the parts of cells that we know are damaged in Parkinson's disease. Many are fat-soluble, so they dissolve in the fatty brain. Some of these other chemicals have been much less studied, but we know that these pesticides, even when we feed the pesticides to laboratory animals, they develop the behavioral features of Parkinson's, including a tremor and the pathological features when you look at their brain.
Mm. We are talking about Parkinson's disease and efforts to end it. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Parkinson's disease with Dr. Michael Okun, Chair of Neurology at the University of Florida and one of the world's leading Parkinson's researchers. He's also the National Medical Director of the Parkinson's Foundation, and Ray Dorsey, Professor of Neurology at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Center for Health and Technology. They, along with Drs. Shearer and Blum, are the authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ray, what do we know about the links between Parkinson's and head trauma? You know, and is there evidence that even minor head insults over the course of a lifetime can be a risk factor?
Yes. So unfortunately, head trauma does increase as the risk for Parkinson's disease. You know, the most prominent boxer in the world, Muhammad Ali, suffered Parkinson's disease or a Parkinson's-related disorder. So we know that significant head trauma that associated with amnesia or loss of consciousness significantly increases the risk of Parkinson's disease. And we know that repeated concussions also increase the risk of Parkinson's disease. So, for example, among football players who have chronic traumatic encephalopathy, about 40 to 50% of them have Parkinsonian features in their lives before they die.
Dr. Okun, what about the links between exercise, diet, and Parkinson's? Is there evidence that we can reduce our risk of Parkinson's through lifestyle changes?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and so people realize that this was a hard no several years ago, and it is shifting to a maybe, and we believe it's starting to tip toward a yes in certain areas, and there is a tremendous amount of really nice research in areas like exercise, and I often say coffee, tea, and exercise all have really positive effects on the brain. And now looking at a lot of those individually, we're beginning to see that the bets, and sort of we look at these large studies looking at associations of people who have exercised and those who haven't and those with Parkinson and those who haven't, that these types of interventions may decrease the number of people actually converting to a diagnosis of Parkinson. And so that's your risk. So that's one half of the equation. And a lot of people get confused with the risk of getting Parkinson. And then once you have Parkinson, some of these same interventions, exercise and diet, may actually be individual treatments. And so there are two lines of really interesting research and interesting changes in terms of how we're clinically thinking about this. And Melissa Armstrong and I wrote this article for JAMA about current recommendations for treatment of Parkinson's disease just within the past year. And it is very clear that the experts in the field have looked at the evidence, weighed the evidence, and exercise, for one, is now considered a first-line therapy for Parkinson, which is, really amazing. And so everybody, even if you can't walk, there's still ways that you can exercise, even seated. And so this has been a huge change in the field. And now we're beginning to see a tremendous number of studies coming, looking at risks of various diets. And Dr. Dorsey can tell you that the Mediterranean diet is beginning to show in multiple studies that that may have an effect on risk. And we are looking at the microbiome, all the things that live in your gut, and realizing there's a gut-brain relationship that's going on. And there are now multiple centers around the entire world looking at dietary effects, both for the risk, which is one side that we talked about, but also once you get Parkinson, if you get Parkinson, could it be a treatment? So a lot of excitement going on in that area.
Ray, because Parkinson's can progress and present so differently in each person, I imagine finding the right treatment and therapies would be a full-time job for patients and families. So tell us a little bit about how Parkinson Net and how that all works.
So Parkinson Net was the creation of our colleague and co-author, Dr. Bastian Bloem in the Netherlands. And he recognized that the care that people received from a one-time visit to a neurologist or an annual visit to a neurologist was incomplete and insufficient to address their needs. So he trained therapists, occupational speech and physical therapists throughout the country about how to care for people with Parkinson's disease, to address mobility issues, to address swallowing issues, to address speech, which are all affected in Parkinson's disease. And he now has the largest network of multidisciplinary care providers for Parkinson's disease ever created. He's done this in the Netherlands. He's done this in Luxembourg. He's even brought this team to parts of the United States. And it's really changes the way that care is provided from Parkinson's by moving beyond just a neurologist and a patient to address a holistic needs of people affected by the condition.
Yeah, I was going to say, and that Mediterranean diet, Sue, that comes up quite a bit as healthy for a lot of different things, right? Heart, when you talk about dementias, and that Mediterranean diet seems like the way to go.
Yeah, so Mediterranean diet and exercise, in some studies, have been associated with a 20% decreased risk of ever developing the disease if you follow them in your 40s and 50s. And even for those with the disease, they seem to be beneficial. So Mediterranean diet, just for your listeners, is low in animal products and high in fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. Dr. Okun, how can technology, especially advances in how we use technology since the start of COVID, the COVID-19 pandemic, how can that help Parkinson's patients?
Yeah, so it's really a good question. And the COVID-19 experience has taught us a lot. And we recently wrote an op-ed in the Daily Beast about, the need for an operation, quote, warp speed for Parkinson's disease, asking that, fundamental question, what if we sped up? And just if you think about COVID-19, on December 1st, 2019, we had the first human case of COVID-19 that was ever documented. And then think how quickly things move. Less than 6 weeks later, we have a genetic sequence unlocked by the National Institutes of Health. Within 5 days, we have an mRNA vaccine in development. And then as we're going past that 1 year mark, we have several vaccines that have made it to human use, several more that are coming. And so the speed of those achievements shows us that when we invest properly and we're thinking about, what we can do, we can really change the face of how we think about diseases. And in the book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, Ray and I and Boss and Todd, we dug deep into the research to look at other diseases to see how they did it and how they got to these technological innovations. So we looked at polio, we looked at HIV, we looked at other diseases, and what we came up with was this idea of a pill of a pact. And these are the four pillars that need to be in place in order for us to advance quickly toward meaningful trajectory change in diseases. And so the pact, each letter stands for something: prevent, advocate, care, and treat. And when we think about that, and getting back to your question about research and innovation, we have to think about how do we drive that. And when we look at the largest funder of health care in the United States, it's the National Institutes of Health, and in fact, the largest funder of research in the world, we're putting about $200 million a year into all of these great ideas about Parkinson's, which, by the way, include things like monoclonal antibodies and vaccines and some of the same approaches that you've seen in COVID-19, but also neuroimmunology. We talked about diets. We talked about the microbiome, different devices. So there's all sorts of great things and great ideas that are out there. But what if we sped up? Well, if we look at these other diseases, Mindy, what we're seeing is that we put about $200 million a year into Parkinson's, and we put about $3 billion, that's billion with a B, into HIV, to move that trajectory for HIV, which we all know went from a disease that when I was an intern was, wards of people that seemed like an untreatable death sentence, to a totally treatable and really digestible disease for the public, and we really made serious progress. So if we're going to make progress, we need to get all these great ideas from these scientists, and even if we doubled from 200 to 400 million, think how many more young people, think how many more ideas we would get to. But we need to go more than a factor of 10 times if we're going to sprint and speed up, and we're going to push devices, we're going to push the neuroimmunology, understand inflammation, understand vaccines, and understand how we can fundamentally treat the disease, which is the T in PACT. We need to prevent, advocate, care, and treat.
So where do we stand in the United States and worldwide with research funding? And where do you think that the Parkinson's research dollars could be best spent? We're talking $200 million for the U.S. How does that compare to what else is happening globally?
Ray, you want to take that?
You go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, so maybe we both can tackle that, you know, together. Ray has done a lot of great work on the health economics, and certainly the United States has had, you know, the large share of this funding, and also through foundations like the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the Parkinson's Foundation that I've worked as their medical director for. Lots of money is being pushed in from lots of organizations, but the numbers really pale when we look at that. Country by country. And Ray, do you want to comment on those numbers?
So I think one way to look at it is, what's the economic burden of Parkinson's disease? And the economic burden of Parkinson's disease is $50,000 per person in the U.S., which amounts to $50 billion. Mm-hmm. And as Michael said, we're investing $200 million. So we're investing less than 1% of the economic burden of Parkinson's disease into research to treat and to prevent the disease. And that's just not going to get it done. As Michael indicated, we invest $3 billion a year in HIV research, and HIV affects a comparable number of Americans as Parkinson's disease. And think not only about the treatments that we have for HIV, but how many people have never developed HIV because we've changed our practices, sexual practices, you know, the use of condoms, and developed treatments to prevent people from ever developing the disease in the first place. There are thousands of your listeners, at least hundreds of your listeners, who don't have HIV today, because a group of activists in the 1980s made their voices heard and increased funding for HIV research from $0 a year to, you know, what it is now at $3 billion a year. If we do the same thing for Parkinson's disease, we can change the course of Parkinson's disease, develop better treatments for those who already have the disease, and importantly and critically, prevent people from ever developing the disease in the first place. Mm.
Dr. Okun, I was also interested to read in the book that there is research into a vaccine that could treat Parkinson's. Would you explain how that would work and where we stand in that research?
Yeah, so the idea is simple. We have these proteins, these abnormal proteins that deposit in the brain. And when we look at those proteins underneath a microscope, they have a consistency, sort of like what their concrete is made out of, like what are the components inside. They consistently have this protein called alpha-synuclein. And so the idea that people have come up with is similar to what you see with the development of COVID-19 vaccines, is what if you could teach the body to identify that alpha-synuclein that's depositing in all these areas of the brain, as Ray discussed at the beginning of this radio broadcast, and that what if we taught the human body to identify it and clear that? So you have what are called plaques, like you get plaques on your teeth, you get plaques on your brain in Parkinson, and what if we could teach the body through a vaccine to just go get those plaques, clear them off, and give you a clean brain? So that's one approach, and there are at least two companies that have already made it through safety testing of vaccines. And so you can see all the latest research at clinicaltrials.gov. That's where all of these clinical trials for Parkinson and for other diseases are registered in the public domain. And so we're watching those, and they've passed safety. And the idea is we don't know. We actually don't know if making the brain clean, you know, brushing the plaques off, is just going to mean you're going to have a clean brain, but it's too late. You still have Parkinson and have still undergone that damage, or whether it could modify how the disease progresses, or could it be symptomatic? Could people get better? Or alternatively, could there be bad adverse side effects from this approach? The other approach is the monoclonal antibody approach that I think you were alluding to, and that's just like COVID. You put in these antibodies and you program them against something like alpha-synuclein, and you keep infusing these, and you see if you can decrease the levels. So there's a lot of debate in the field, whether it's too late, whether we're targeting the right components of this abnormal player, this abnormal sort of mineral in the middle of the concrete that sort of deposits in your brain. And so we need to take a look at that. But the key thing here is, our understanding of a field called neuroinflammation, how the brain gets, you know, inflamed and angry when it sees a response, and how we can use the immune system like folks have done in cancer, and now you see it in infectious diseases here with COVID-19. Can we begin to use this technology to both better understand the process, figure out when to target it? So it may be that we're too early and we're on the wrong path, but, you know, most people may not know this, but 90-95% of medical research ends in negative findings, meaning we didn't get where we wanted to go. But that doesn't mean we didn't take the right step in the right direction. So I think it's pretty exciting that we're exploring and we're going to try to answer these questions. And it comes back to you know, what we were talking about before. What if we sped up? What if we did this faster before Parkinson overcomes our economies and overcomes our ability for healthcare systems to be able to care for these, you know, doubling numbers of you know, people that are going to be in our health system?
You end the book with a list of 25 steps we can take to end Parkinson's. And Ray, let's start with you. What do you think are the most important first steps?
Well, the first response to any pandemic is to contain it. So whether that's COVID, so by physical distancing, getting vaccines to prevent other people from becoming infected, or a fire where you shut the door so it doesn't get oxygen. Right now, we're only fueling the Parkinson's pandemic. We're continuing to use pesticides and chemicals that we know contribute to Parkinson's disease. We need our first step needs to be to prevent Parkinson's disease by banning certain pesticides like paraquat, another pesticide called chlorpyrifos, ban chemicals like trichloroethylene that are strongly linked to Parkinson's disease and prevent people from ever getting the disease in the first place.
And then Dr. Okun, same question. What do you think are some of the most important first steps?
So I think that that the A and the PACT, prevent, advocate, care, and treat, I think we really need to focus on that A and increase our advocacy, which is going to drive all other arms. We saw this with HIV. We've seen this with polio. And we need to have a much better response. And we certainly saw with HIV the peaceful occupation of the FDA. We saw the occupation of the cap of the mall with quilts, with the March of Dimes and the mailing of dimes to the White House. And our advocacy efforts have not matched up to what we've seen in other diseases. And we have the data, as Ray says, about pesticides, and we have the data about risks. We have the data about how we can change our lives today. And we need to do a better job getting people on board. And I am happy to say that since we wrote the book, a group called the PD Avengers, it's almost like superheroes. They call themselves the Parkinson's Disease Avengers, and they're on Twitter and other social media platforms. They have a grassroots movement and a petition, and they're moving to educate people and to try to become more aggressive and more charismatic. And I think that's what we need to be doing.
Dr. Michael Okun, Chair of Neurology at the University of Florida and one of the world's leading Parkinson's researchers, Ray Dorsey, Professor of Neurology at the University of Rochester, where he directs the Center for Health and Technology, both co-authors of Ending Parkinson's Disease, A Prescription for Action. We'll post more information about the book at our website, capeandislands.org. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Coming up after break, we discuss local supports and services for Parkinson's patients and their caregivers. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about Parkinson's disease this hour. Joining us is Bill Patjane, who's the executive director of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Parkinson's Disease Association. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
Describe the role of the American Parkinson's Disease Association and how you work with patients throughout the state.
Sure. So earlier I was listening to the two doctors, Dorsey and Okun, talk about the burden of families, and there's a significant burden to those with Parkinson's disease. And what the American Parkinson's Disease Association tries to do is tries to relieve the burden on those families with Parkinson's disease. And we do that with a multi-level or multi-tiered approach. We have a chapter on Cape Cod called the Parkinson Support Network, that is an arm of the APDA. And we have great partners on the Cape, one of which is Spalding Rehab Cape Cod, that provide great programs to the community. They have Healthy Mindset Program, a Rocksteady Boxing Program, yoga programs. They also offer physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech programming for the community. The APDA provides a multi-level support for those that are dealing with Parkinson's disease. The first of which is we have an information and referral center that's based at BU Medical Center in Boston. And so that's the repository of the information so that people can call and they can help find the proper care. And that's critically important for people with Parkinson's, is to find, you know, the correct doc to deal with their situation. The doctors earlier spoke about specialty training, and we're able to help them navigate through the process of finding the proper doctor. And in most cases, the best doctor to see is a movement disorder specialist, which is trained in and around Parkinson's disease. The APDA also provides printed materials that we're able to provide the community, which is incredibly important to make sure that they have the information they need. We have support groups. The support groups are very important to the community on Cape Cod. Right now, some of our support groups are on pause. The one on Chatham, Harwich, and Brewster is on pause. But we also have one on the Vineyard and one in Mashpee that both Jay and Jean will talk about later on. And
yeah, matter of fact, Jean Jackson, she's a care partner of a spouse living with Parkinson's disease, facilitator of the Mashpee Support Group, and she's also a retired nurse. Jean, welcome.
Thank you, Mindy.
And Jay Zavala, he's a physically active retiree living in Falmouth and a board member of the Parkinson's Support Network Cape Cod. Hi, Jay.
Hi, good morning, Mindy. Good to be on WBAI.
Yeah, Jay, describe the moment you received your diagnosis of Parkinson's. What went through your mind?
Well, fear, anger, frustration, ignorance, everything. It was no understanding of what Parkinson's was. I felt I was all alone, and I was actually grateful because I found out that I had Parkinson's and that I did not have ALS. It was a journey that finally got me there through visiting with some great neurologists.
So, Jay, what helped you determine what supports might be beneficial, and how did you go about finding access locally?
Well, Mindy, that's a great question. It's really quite personal, but it had to do with my wife, Susan. She's a retired nurse, and I know that she cares deeply about our health. And when I realized that I would need her help as I aged with Parkinson's, that I wanted to be able to take care of myself as well as I could to minimize the effect it would have on her. And so I felt that if I became educated, I would know how to better maintain myself, because I learned, first off, that it's a degenerative disease and that over time there are things that one can do, as Dr. Dorsey, the doctors mentioned. I just started exploring, trying to find out what was going on, who was in our community, what we could do. And lo and behold, I found the Parkinson's Support Network, where I found educational symposia. I found a great support group. And now today, I found a great exercise program through Spalding, the Rocksteady Boxing. And so I'm physically active. I'm involved in the Parkinson's community. We help educate one another. And a very strong component is that we help the caregivers or the care partners as they struggle to help us live a better life.
Right. Jean, you've said that when your husband received his diagnosis, he was in denial, but you decided the best approach was to get educated about the disease. What resources were available at that time?
Well, I realized that I didn't know very much about Parkinson's. And when he got the diagnosis, he was told by our neurologist that he had about 5 years to live. So at this point, he was a very active man. So that didn't, you know, resonate with me at all. So I saw an ad in the paper, one of those little announcements about a talk by a movement specialist, neurologist about Parkinson's. And that was through the agency that Jay has mentioned. Anyway, I went and listened to this and realized how much I didn't know. And I knew I didn't know much, but I didn't know how much. And so I started to educate myself, and after a couple of meetings that I attended, my husband started going with me, and he really understood right away that the knowledge is power, and he still stayed in somewhat of denial, but he did start to go, and we did all the things. He was very active, and he's always been an athlete, and so I think that had helped him a lot prior to the diagnosis. Yeah. So he was diagnosed about 15 years ago, but we know he's had it for about 50 years. He had some of those early symptoms when we were married. So I know two of the risk factors are the two highest risk factors are falls and aspiration. And Harold he had so many multiple falls that it's just too many to count.
So
do you have a question?
I was going to ask Bill, how has the pandemic impacted the availability of supports and activities for patients?
Well, luckily, I became involved in this Parkinson's Support Network immediately, and I found Kathy Thomas out of the APDA in Boston has been wonderful. Joyce, who initiated that network, has since left, but Kathy has always been involved, and she was like my go-to guru person.
Yeah.
So I was able to find the different things like the spinning that we have at the Y that's on pause, and more Rock City groups that are on the Cape, and a wonderful trainer, physical therapist, in addition to the therapist at Spalding. And we experienced them all, excuse me. Harold was an inpatient at Spalding several times for complications of his Parkinson's. And so I have to tell you, it isn't easy. Parkinson, I think, is like the doctors earlier might have mentioned, I think I heard something in there about how hard it is to find information. It's like a best-kept secret. Yeah. And so I think I'm really excited about hearing about these PD advocates people are.
Yeah, that they were talking about. Yeah, look for it. Yeah. So, Bill, how has the pandemic impacted availability for supports and activities for patients?
Yeah, we actually have done a very good job with the APDA at shifting to virtual environment. And many of our programs and services have been very successful. And we see a very high appetite as it relates to programs. So all of our programs have shifted to virtual and in those cases where those programs are available. So support groups have been fantastic. We have virtual education programs, signature programs called the PRESS program, the Take Control monthly educational programs, and then we have other lectures that we deliver on a national basis. We also have something that's been incredibly important for us. It's been the financial scholarship support. And what that is that people have the availability to apply for a $300 scholarship that they can use for a wide range of things, such as, durable medical items, drugs that they might need, and exercise programs. And, what we've seen is that there's been a real important shift as it relates to moving a lot of the programs, some of which, the exercise programs have been, successfully administered online. We have somebody from Rhode Island, actually, that's been taking a Rock City boxing class that's delivered in Alaska, believe it or not.
Wow.
And, what we've seen is that, in Cape Cod, although not an island, we know that there are areas that are remote. What we've seen is that the programs are actually become more available to people once they've gotten over the technology part.
That's the tough part. Yeah. So, I want to ask Jay, how has the pandemic impacted your treatment or access to local supports?
Well, initially, of course, like everyone else, it was sort of everything stopped. So the good folks over at Spalding, after a three-month period and when they were allowed to do so, put together a very good program of protecting individuals from one another, and were able to start the programs back up again. I remember Dr. Dorsey talking about PD Avengers. I like to think that APDA and the Parkinson's Support Network is the PD Avengers of New England. there's a great deal of education that's being offered. There's a great deal of support for the caregivers and care partners. We're linked together. We're tied together. We talk to one another. One of the big problems with PD is the depression that occurs to almost to all of us. I like to think that I walk on the sunny side of the street, but sometimes it's difficult, and it's nice to be able to get in touch with one of my parkie friends and talk about what we're doing and how we're doing it, and knowing that we're fighting PD on a daily basis.
Yeah. Jay, how important are the social connections for you then, and have you been able to maintain them during the pandemic?
Yes, actually we have. Although I live in a bubble, just like everyone else at this particular time, I know that through emails and through some of the programs, that the educational symposiums that are put on through APDA, you know, Bill is a great advocate. I'm glad that he's our executive director, because he brings these programs to us and alerts us of what's going on. And so it gives us a connection, a social connection, not only with our neighbors, but also with folks across New England and beyond. Here on the Cape alone, through our social group gatherings with Gene on Zoom, we're able to chat with one another and take virtual walks together. And so there's a very strong component. I don't know why it is, Mindy, but seems to some of the best people I've met on Cape Cod have Parkinson's.
Gene, as a nurse and a caregiver for your husband, you know that caring for the caregiver is so important. So what helped you the most when you were caring for your husband?
Probably the support of my family. And I feel it's a team effort that everybody has to get on board, be kept up to date on what's going on, because the symptoms change so quickly and subtly sometimes that, you just have to be prepared for anything. And so, it really is the reaching out, and which is a very, certainly a challenge right now, especially for the older community. And most of these people are, more elderly and aren't tech savvy.
Right. We have about a minute left. And Jay, what would you say to someone who was recently diagnosed with Parkinson's or has a loved one diagnosed? What advice would you give them?
I would say educate yourself immediately. Turn to the Parkinson's Support Network, and you have a family here waiting for you. We'll help you through the crisis.
All right, Bill, any last words?
Mindy, I would say that the main important part of this whole program is to our information and referral center. And the phone number for that is 617-638-8466. And what we can do is help you navigate the process and provide you with the right information and the right support along the way.
Yeah, and we will post more information about programs and services for Parkinson's patients and their caregivers locally at our website, capeandislands.org. Bill, Pat Jane, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Chapter of the American Parkinson's Disease Association, Gene Jackson, caregiver of a spouse living with Parkinson's and facilitator of the Mashpee Support Group, and Jay Savala, retiree and board member of the Parkinson's Support Network Cape Cod. Thank you all for taking time to be with us this morning. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.